This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of The World at One from BBC Radio 4. The World at One, this is Martha Carney with 45 minutes of news and comment. The Foreign Secretary has rejected Russia's claim that an apparent chemical attack in Syria was caused by the bombing of a rebel warehouse. Boris Johnson voiced his frustration during a conference on Syria this morning in Brussels.
We're all here trying to assemble a sticking plaster when there are still governments here supporting the Assad regime, which is inflicting those wounds with weapons that were banned a century ago.
We'll hear from a surgeon in Idlib province where the attack took place and ask if the West should get tougher on Syria and Russia. The Deputy Labour leader Tom Watson has said the decision to suspend but not expel Ken Livingstone over his comments about Hitler shames the party. The Shadow Brexit Secretary Keir Starmer agrees.
I think he should have been expelled rather than suspended. So far as I'm concerned, it should be zero tolerance, and that means robust sanctions.
We'll talk to a leading Labour activist who says he's cancelling his donations. We'll also ask if locums should get a pay rise now they're paying more tax. And we've news about a grandmother caught urinating on Donald Trump's golf course in Aberdeenshire. The BBC News is read by Zeb Soans.
A major Syrian opposition group says it believes President Trump's softer stance towards the Assad regime is emboldening the Syrian leader to carry out more crimes. The Syrian National Coalition said Washington had become a spectator in the conflict. More than 70 people were killed yesterday in an apparent chemical weapons attack, which has been widely blamed on the Syrian military. Our diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus reports.
Two narratives have emerged about the chemical incident in Syria's Idlib province yesterday. The Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, arriving at a Syria aid conference in Brussels this morning, summed up the dominant view of Western experts by noting that all the evidence he has seen suggests that this was the Assad regime using illegal weapons on its own people. The Russian government accepts that there were Syrian aircraft involved, but asserts that their bombs struck a terrorist warehouse releasing the chemicals. With the World Health Organization confirming that some of the victims do indeed have symptoms consistent with exposure to nerve agent, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that war crimes are going on in Syria. Opening the aid conference, he said that the UN Security Council, which meets later today, was facing a moment of truth. But it has been deeply divided on Syria from the outset, and the competing Russian and Western narratives suggest little likelihood of agreement.
The European Parliament has set out its priorities for Brexit negotiations, warning that the UK government must agree to honour any financial obligations to the EU. The former UKIP leader Nigel Farage was heckled when he accused MEPs of behaving like the mafia, setting a ransom demand. From Strasbourg, Dan Johnson reports.
These guidelines were almost guaranteed to get approval. For some, the support is another symbol of European unity. They call for an early settlement of Britain's bills and sorting out the Irish border. An agreement of what rights citizens will enjoy is a key priority, and there's insistence that the UK's new relationship cannot replicate the benefits of EU membership. One of the few dissenting voices was Nigel Farage, who described European demands as unreasonable. In a debate that was at times bad-tempered, he said Britain was being held to ransom, the hostage of a European mafia. These guidelines are not binding. It is the priorities and preferred timeline of other EU leaders to be agreed at a summit later this month that will shape the negotiation. But MEPs have expressed their view and they'll have a vote on the final deal.
Labour's deputy leader Tom Watson has called his party's decision not to expel Ken Livingstone over his comments about Adolf Hitler and Zionism incomprehensible. The former mayor of London was suspended yesterday for another year. Mr. Watson said Mr. Livingstone's behaviour shamed the party. Figures released by the government have revealed that Britain's overseas aid budget grew by 10% last year to more than £13 billion. The amount is ring-fenced at 0.7% of national income. Ministers say the money makes the UK more powerful on the global stage. But critics argue that more should be spent on projects at home. The number of new cars registered in the UK hit a new record in March. Figures from the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders indicate that the market grew by 8.4% compared to the same month last year. Sales of diesel cars continue to rise despite the ongoing controversy about the pollution they produce, but their share of the market as a whole fell. is our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
More new cars were registered in March than in January and February combined. The SMMT said many people seized the opportunity to buy before changes to the way new cars are taxed came into force on the 1st of April. Under the new vehicle excise duty system, high-value cars and some low-emissions models now face greater charges than before. Registrations of electric and hybrid vehicles were 31% higher than the previous year. More than a quarter of a million diesel-powered cars were registered, the highest monthly total ever. However, their share of the market as a whole did fall sharply. Theresa May has hinted that the government could provide help for drivers of older diesel cars who are expected to face significant charges for driving into London and several other city centres over the next few years.
BMW workers are to hold 8 one-day strikes at the carmakers' plants across England beginning later this month. The Unite Union says the industrial action about plans to close the company's final salary pension scheme will significantly disrupt production. BMW has insisted it has to make changes to improve competitiveness and protect future pension provision. A service of hope and reconciliation is taking place in Westminster Abbey a fortnight after the attack near the Houses of Parliament. Khalid Massoud drove a car into pedestrians on Westminster Bridge, killing 3 people and fatally stabbed a police officer before he was shot dead. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and Prince Harry have joined about 2,000 people attending the multi-faith service. Our royal correspondent, Peter Hunt, is there.
This was a gathering of those directly affected when Khalid Massoud, first with a car and then with 2 knives, in just 82 seconds, murdered and maimed. The congregation included Melissa Cochran, who is in a wheelchair and who is still recovering from the attack that left her husband, Kurt, dead. They'd been celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary. Mrs. Cochran was joined by others who've been bereaved, including members of Keith Palmer's family. The police officer was killed trying to protect others. In his address, the Dean of Westminster, Dr. John Hall, said the events of 2 weeks ago had left people bewildered and disturbed. "We weep for the violence," he went on, "for the hatred, for the loss of life. It was not meant to be like this."
Peter Hunt reporting. The French President François Hollande this morning called for an international response to the suspected chemical attack that killed scores of civilians in Syria, calling it a war crime. The United Nations Security Council is holding emergency talks today. The UK, the US and France have proposed a resolution condemning Syria following yesterday's strike on the rebel-held town of Khan Sheikhoun. Dr. Osama Abu Ez is a surgeon from Khan Sheikhoun who was treating some of those affected by the attack until early this morning.
I went to Khan Sheikhoun yesterday to see the situation. Number of deaths until this time, about 100, most of them children and women. The number of casualties in general, about 500. A lot of them in very dangerous cases. There are a number of these casualties go across boarding to Turkey, and they are now treating in the hospitals in Turkey. Because some of those casualties in very horror cases and need ICUs and supporting them by ventilators and need some medication, which didn't found now in our hospitals. After this attack, about 4 hours, these jets targeting medical center in the eastern side of Khan Sheikhoun and made him out of service. So a lot of patients and children didn't found medical center to treat them and servicing them by the emergency services. A few days ago, Marra Hospital have been targeted by regime jets and it's now out of the service. Marra Hospital is the biggest medical center in this area. This morning, I go out of Khan Sheikhoun. The situation very, very bad. And the shelling and the attacking continue until this moment. So a lot of people go out of the city to save their lives and their children.
Dr. Osama Abu Ez. So how will the international community respond? President Trump was very critical of President Obama's failure to act after the Assad regime was accused of killing as many as 1,400 people with sarin gas, describing it as a national humiliation. But action's complicated. Given that Russian forces are supporting Assad, could the US be drawn into a superpower conflict? And if Assad falls, could the vacuum be filled by Islamist terrorists? Speaking to a House of Lords committee 3 months ago, the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson appeared open to the idea of the Assad regime remaining part of the political picture in Syria as part of a peace deal brokered by Russia.
If they can get a negotiated ceasefire that leads to a political settlement, that leads to some sort of democratic arrangement that transitions away from Assad, then, you know, in my view, that might not be a bad thing. And we should be open. We should be open intellectually.
But this morning, addressing a special conference on Syria taking place in Brussels, the Foreign Secretary made a thinly veiled attack on Russia for its continued support of the Assad regime.
We must accept the paradox of this meeting today, that we're all here together trying to assemble a vast multi-billion sticking plaster when there are still governments here supporting the Assad regime, which is inflicting those wounds. And inflicting them, I might say, with weapons that were banned internationally a century ago. The people of Syria are today paying a price for our collective inaction over the last 5 years and of decisions we took. We cannot now undo those mistakes, but we can and we must work together to alleviate their suffering, to help Syria's neighbours and to prepare Syria for the moment when peace finally returns.
Boris Johnson, so does this apparent chemical attack by the Syrian regime warrant a change in attitudes at the Foreign Office? Well, I'm joined now by the Conservative MP and former Minister for the Middle East, Alistair Burt. This is not the first time the international community has been faced with evidence of a chemical attack by the Assad regime, but are there any signs of a different response to that?
I doubt it, Martha. I think the Foreign Secretary sums up the dilemmas rather well. Time has passed since the opportunity in 2013, perhaps, to deal with what President Obama called his red line, and the reality is rather different now. I think the best hope lies in continuing with political efforts to bring an end to this. Whether or not the tragedy of yesterday just makes those closest to Assad think more carefully and realise that they cannot go on forever supporting a regime capable of this sort of action and prompts them into some of the work that they must do. But I think to see any precipitate military response in relation to this is unlikely, though I think the horror and the tragedy of yesterday, which can't and shouldn't be minimised, may well spur some greater diplomatic action because this has already lasted far too long for the Syrian people.
But there's been diplomatic initiative after diplomatic initiative. And as you say, in a way, since 2013, things have got even more difficult, haven't they? And pragmatically, President Assad is winning with Russian forces, isn't he? There's no prospect really of dislodging him, is there, militarily?
No, but the tragedy is exactly as you speak. And there is no resolution to these matters until there is a resolution. So it's inevitable that the talk goes on until one night, one evening, there is a ceasefire agreed and something else gets put in place that allows the opportunity for some further democratic development. I think what should also be made clear, though, is whether or not there is any role for Assad in any transitional arrangements in order to ensure that both Russia and Iran keep face in some way. The United Kingdom, I'm sure, and Boris Johnson made it clear today, cannot contemplate a future in which a Syria led by Assad has any normal relationship with the United Kingdom, and that we must move in company with the Syrian people to a different answer. But however
distasteful that prospect might be, if he were to fall, isn't the risk there of leaving the vacuum which could be filled by Islamic State on Syria becoming a failed state?
Of course. I mean, and that is why the diplomatic efforts are as they are. That is why so many nations are engaged with it. People have seen, of course, because of events over the last 5 years, what happens if there is a vacuum. But equally, you know, what Western powers also need to understand is what vacuum it leaves and the West leaves if they don't take action to support a people and others step in. It will be unknown forever whether or not any action taken in 2013 could have prevented what we've seen today, whether it would have intensified it and made it worse, or whether we would just have seen exactly the same. Yeah. But that sense of a vacuum, of course, that is why the diplomatic work is going on, to make sure that doesn't happen.
Alistair Burt, thank you. Well, given the claims were saying that the attack was a war crime, will anyone end up being prosecuted? The resolution being discussed at the United Nations calls later today for those responsible to be held accountable. But how? David Crane is the founding chief prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone, which indicted the former president of Liberia, Charles Taylor. He's also the founding member of the Syrian Accountability Project, which has compiled a 20-page indictment against President Assad. So do you think that will yesterday's attack change anything in the charge to bring down President Assad?
Well, I would concur with the previous commentary. At this point in time, no. We're not going to see a move for accountability. I think we're caught in a situation between peace versus justice. We may have to have some type of peace before we get justice. But I can assure your listeners that justice will be had. It may not be right now. It may not be 5 years from now or 10 years from now. But eventually, Assad and his henchmen and all others in Syria who are committing war crimes and crimes against humanity could be held accountable for what they've done. There's no statute of limitations for international crimes.
How will you hold him accountable? What kind of evidence are you compiling?
Well, again, since March of 2011, there have been several very credible non-governmental organizations creating packages. The Syrian Accountability Project has taken the lessons learned and the methodologies that I used to take down President Charles Taylor, a crime-based matrix, a conflict map, criminal analysis of the crimes that have taken place, along with sample indictments of all of those who bear the greatest responsibility for what has taken place in Syria. This package someday will be handed over to a domestic, regional, or international prosecutor. So I can assure you that even though it looks bleak now, and it does, and it is very bleak, over time we will see Assad and others most likely held accountable. At the end of the day, modern international criminal law, the bright red thread of all of that is politics. So there may become a geopolitical condition by which Assad and his henchmen and all others who were involved in this tragedy will be turned over for accountability.
Is there a risk, though, if you convince President Assad that he's going to be prosecuted, will it make it less likely that he'll submit to any deal? In a way, he'll have nothing to lose.
Well, again, that's a little bit farther down the road. That could be as much as 5 or 10 years down the road regarding the justice piece of this. So we would have to look at a way by which we can just stop the killing, arrive at a geopolitical solution, and then over time there may be an opportunity by which then we can start holding people accountable. But yes, it's an important question. Heads of state, dictators, and thugs are always looking over their shoulder at the now the paradigm of modern international criminal law. They are aware of it, they know of it, and they know of the work that we're doing. But again, it remains to be seen whether that's going to be held out. I know that they've done it before, where they've used the justice piece to try to negotiate that away for a political peace. But that remains to be seen.
David Crane, thank you for talking to us. So what kind of action can or will the United Nations take? They're meeting later today. Valerie Amos, Baroness Amos, was the UN's humanitarian coordinator between 2010 and 2015 and joins us on the line now. Looking ahead to the meeting later on today, aren't we likely to see a repeat of what's happened in the past, that there'll be simply a Russian veto on any action against Assad?
Unfortunately, Martha, I think that that is absolutely the case, that there will be an impasse at the Security Council, that people will look at the horrific pictures that we've all seen, that there will be statements made by the countries that are on the Security Council about how awful this is. But in terms of what is to be done about it, the Security Council will not agree. And we have seen this year in, year out in relation to the Syria conflict. And there is a kind of political paralysis in the system now. Time is the one thing that the people of Syria absolutely do not have. Chemical weapons have been used before. We did see in 2013 the Security Council coming together to try to get Syria to get rid of these chemical weapons. And of course, all the members of the Security Council were on board at that point. But we keep saying there's no military solution, that there has to be a political solution, but we're no closer to that political solution, and that's what's so frustrating.
Do you think that the change of president of the United States will make any difference? President Trump was very critical of President Obama's failure to act last time. He set a red line over chemical actions but didn't follow that through.
Well, it's not clear what that change will deliver in terms of any kind of action on the ground. And I thought it was interesting that yesterday President Trump and his spokesperson continued to point the finger backwards at President Obama rather than looking forward in terms of what could be done. We all know that any kind of shift or change can make a significant difference in terms of negotiations. It would be interesting to see, for example, if this gets taken to the UN General Assembly, which is all the member states of the United Nations, rather than just focusing on the Security Council, where we all know that there will be a veto. It's much more likely that you will get a majority of countries on the General Assembly saying that some action has absolutely got to be taken on this. We can't continue in this way. And yes, the gathering of the evidence so that in the longer term there can be some accountability, that's fine. But how long are we going to let this go on?
Well, even if you did get consent from the UN General Assembly, and I'm sure you'd accept that's quite a big if to take that route, what action do you think they should be agreeing on?
Well, it's hard to say. We need something that will make a concrete difference, make a shift in terms of those political negotiations. All that has happened is that the delay, the number of years that this has taken, has meant that in a way we have gone backwards, that a resolution seems to be taking longer and longer, because the longer this goes on, the stronger the Syrian regime feels. The more space is created for ISIL and other terrorist organisations to occupy. So that does not then create the kind of confidence and stability on the ground that enables a political solution to be brokered that people have confidence in.
And what about the humanitarian response? Because doctors in the province of Idlib, where the attack took place, said they could have saved more lives if they had antidotes for chemical weapons.
So you need the humanitarian aid to be flowing through. You need to recognise, and I think that this keeps getting lost as well, that there are allegations that clinics treating the wounded were attacked. Now, any kind of attack on a medical facility is a war crime. So there are two counts of war crimes here, the use of chemical weapons and the targeting of medical facilities. So there is a humanitarian imperative here, as well as a human rights protection one as well.
Valerie Amos, Baroness Amos, thank you. It's a row about anti-Semitism which has inflamed the fault lines running through the Labour Party. The long-term ally of Jeremy Corbyn, Ken Livingstone, was found guilty but suspended rather than being expelled. Labour's deputy leader, Tom Watson, who'd already tweeted that the decision had shamed the party, has been speaking within the past half hour.
Well, I respect the fact that the panel have found Ken Livingstone guilty of the charges that were put against him, but I feel ashamed that the sanction has caused yet more offence to thousands of members of the Jewish community in Britain. It's caused great offence to Jews up and down Britain and those people that have been fighting anti-racism as part of their civil and political lives. And the great sadness for me, it seems to me that Ken Livingstone is drunk on his own infamy.
Well, those comments were supported by another senior shadow cabinet member, Keir Starmer.
Labour's rightly got a zero tolerance policy in relation to anti-Semitism, and I think that means robust sanctions. I think he should have been expelled rather than suspended.
Their condemnation of the decision came after the chief rabbi accused the party of failing the Jewish community by not expelling the ex-London mayor, after a row which started a year ago when he made these remarks on BBC Radio London.
Let's remember, when Hitler won his election in 1932, his policy then was that Jews should be moved to Israel. He was supporting Zionism, or he went mad and ended up killing 6 million Jews.
Well, Adrian Cohen is lay chair of Labour Friends of Israel. And just picking up on that clip, I mean, Ken Livingstone says himself he was merely stating historical fact. It's probably worth spelling out why you find those remarks so offensive and so many other people have.
Yeah, good afternoon, Martha. So the concern that I have is, first of all, you have to put his words in context, which was in the middle of a rising concern about anti-Semitism within the party. And his comments really were inflammatory and ahistorical in that to start talking about Zionism and Jews in the 1930s and 40s, which is really to talk about Jews generally during that period, which is, you know, when the most catastrophic events happened to the Jewish people, culminating in the Holocaust and the gassing, shooting and torture of 6 million Jews, really was an incredibly irresponsible and offensive thing to do. By referring to the fact that Hitler supported Zionism, all he's really drawing attention to is the fact that at that stage, Hitler would do anything to expel Jews from Germany. And so it wasn't, of course, Israel at that time. It was mandated Palestine. He was prepared to take measures which encouraged Jews to leave. That's not the same as supporting Zionism. I mean, Hitler had never supported a Jewish state. Hitler despised the Jews. He referred to a Jewish state in Palestine as being a centre of a Jewish conspiracy and a threat to world order.
So we have now the judgment against Ken Livingstone, suspended, not expelled. What kind of action are you going to take as a Labour Party member?
So I joined the party in 82 and I'm heavily invested in the party. It's my party and I'm very loath to resign and leave the party in the hands of those who are either anti-Semitic or are prepared to acquiesce in anti-Semitism. So
but you've been donating money, haven't you? I'm
many people, I'm a modest donor to the party. I mean, one of the immediate things that I will do is, beyond my membership subscriptions, I'm not going to give any money to the Central Labour Party.
And have you heard other people who are planning the same?
Since the decision broke, lots of people that I've spoken to or heard from some have resigned from the party, some are considering resigning from the party, and no doubt there are others who won't be giving money to the party.
Adrian Cohen, thank you for talking to us. The government's crackdown on the way the tax system works for self-employed people is having some unexpected consequences for the National Health Service. Locum doctors are demanding up to 50% more in fees to compensate for the changes. The new so-called IR35 regulations mean that the trust must subtract tax and national insurance from the workers' pay packets at source, rather than letting them be paid through personal service companies. Nurses and other NHS workers will also be affected. Sean Linton is a senior correspondent at the Health Service Journal and has been covering the story. So give us a sense of the scale of the numbers of people who are employed in this freelance way in the health service.
Well, what we know, Martha, is that the NHS, particularly in the public sector, relies on thousands of agency nurses and locum doctors on a daily basis, 365 days a year. These are staff that are used to fill gaps in rotas when the NHS Trust doesn't have permanent staff. So we are talking a large-scale use of these workers across the country. And these new rules particularly affect those who work through what are known as personal service companies, where they, in the past, they may have been paid a sum of money and taken their income as a dividend rather than as paying it as a national insurance tax and income tax. And the government view is that that should be changed. If they are doing the work of an employee, they should be paid or they should be paying rather national insurance and income tax like an employee. So from Thursday, the rules will shift and the NHS will take that at source and pay it to the government and the HMRC office.
With the knock-on effect that they'll these people affected will be end up paying more tax, and so they're asking for more money. What kind of effect is this likely to have on the health service?
Well, what we're hearing is quite worrying. So we have numerous examples from up and down the country of locums turning around and saying either that they will not be showing up for work in the next few weeks, which obviously leaves those wards short-staffed. Or in some cases, we've seen emails where these locums are demanding upwards of 56% increases in their pay. And obviously that comes at a time when the NHS is particularly under strain from a financial point of view. And the NHS has no choice about this. This is the law. And it's been the law for some time in terms of the need to pay this income tax. But it's now the responsibility of the NHS to collect it. And I think we've described it today as a Mexican standoff. And that's what it seems to be. The locums are saying we're not going to work. And the NHS is saying, well, we have to do this. And the impact, of course, is that the patients are caught in the middle between these two sides.
Because could there be gaps in rotas and so on?
Yes. Well, yes. And also we've heard that permanent staff who are obviously employed by the NHS, they're being made to work even harder. So we have examples where some consultants have had their training time cancelled, secondments to other organisations have been suspended and staff pulled back to fill gaps on wards in the next few weeks. And one medical director said to us, if we can hold the line, we might just force a change in the locum market. But if one trust in one area of the country breaks this and pays more to a locum, which we already hear some examples where that might happen, then the whole thing will change, and we could see the NHS being forced to pay more and more for locum costs. It's quite a difficult situation at the moment.
And finally, has there been an increase in the use of locums? Because we hear reports that some people have been leaving the NHS as a result of the Brexit vote.
Yeah, well, it's difficult to get an accurate picture entirely, but anecdotally, we do hear of an increased use of locums, but that's partly down to the way the NHS is itself trying to work. So it's trying to become more seven-day services, etc. Patient demand is rising, so there is a greater demand for numbers of doctors, numbers of nurses. We haven't been training enough in this country for more than a decade now. We haven't been training enough. So from a locums argument, they may well say this is a supply and demand issue. I am in short supply. I'm a professional providing a service. Right. You have to pay me more for that service. But the NHS just doesn't have that money available.
Sean Linton, thank you. Well, let's talk now to the Labour MP, John Ashworth, Shadow Health Secretary. Do you support the government's move to crack down on personal service companies, which a lot of people regard as a way of avoiding paying tax?
Yes, of course. We do broadly support the changes to the regulations, particularly to deal with what we call bogus self-employed, where many people avoid paying tax. And I should emphasise that according to the reports that have been coming out from Sean and others today, that we understand that many, many locums do pay the requisite amount of tax. But clearly we have a problem here, and we are in this Mexican standoff, and unless something changes and the government get a grip, we're going to see patients suffering, because we're going to have huge gaps in rotas, we're going to see permanent staff having to work longer, that means they're, you know, working longer when they're tired and so on. And I'm afraid it's all part of a more broader failure on workforce planning, which indeed the Secretary of State admits to in today's Daily Mail, funnily enough.
But just looking at this particular problem, you say the government needs to take a grip, but doesn't that mean getting trust to spend an awful lot more money?
Well, I think the Secretary of State and the various NHS bodies and NHS bosses quickly and urgently need to come together and provide a solution. Workforce planning in the NHS has been woeful under the government, if I may say so. And it's only going to get worse, by the way, with Brexit, because we're not getting any guarantees for the 140,000 NHS and social care staff who work in our NHS.
Many but the problems of agency start, I mean, that's been, you know, in the NHS for quite a long time. But just to repeat, do you think the NHS, should they be paying locums more to compensate for the amount of tax?
Well, they're not able. I mean, the problem is they're not able to pay more. I mean, already hospitals are in deficit, way beyond the deficits which were predicted for this year, and we suspect there will be beyond the deficits which are being recommended for next year, because the NHS is going through this huge financial squeeze. And it does come back, I'm afraid, to the short-sighted approach from the government.
Well, the government will say that they're putting record amounts of money into the health service,
but
they gave Simon Stevens the amount of money that he asked for. And unlike many other government departments, it is protected when it comes to government spending cuts.
But in the next year, head for head, NHS money will actually be falling in this country. And everybody accepts that the NHS is going through this very big financial squeeze, the biggest in its history. And nobody accepts the figures that the government are proposing. Indeed, Simon Stevens, the NHS boss, has been to various committees of the House of Commons and said he didn't get the money that was asked for, because we've seen huge cuts to public health budgets. We've seen huge cuts to social care budgets, which has had huge knock-on effects in terms of elderly people trapped in hospitals. So I'm afraid it is about the government's incompetent handling of workforce and the underfunding of the NHS.
I wanted to turn to another story in the news today, which is the action taken by the Labour Party over disciplining Ken Livingstone. Do you think it was sufficient to suspend him rather than expel him?
Well, this Ken Livingstone circus, I mean, it's good grief. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn wants us to be focusing on the cuts to short start sentences today, and we've got Ken Livingstone going around the studios yet again. I don't quite understand how the relevant body in the party, it's called the NCC, has come up with this particular judgment if they found him guilty. It's taken me by surprise. It doesn't seem appropriate. I think we need transparency about how they came to that judgment. Perhaps they should publish the transcripts. And it also didn't take into account all the stuff that Ken Livingstone has said in the last few days. So I think there's a case for the NEC looking at this again and maybe asking the relevant Labour Party body to revisit some of this, because it has caused a huge amount of offence, upset. And quite rightly, many people are ashamed about the judgment that we've seen in the last 24 hours.
Because, yeah, Tom Watson, Deputy Leader, has said that the verdict shames us all.
Yes, and I think the Deputy Leader has spoken for many of us in the Labour Party, which is why I think, I mean, I used to be on the NEC, I'm not anymore. The NEC, I know, has zero tolerance on anti-Semitism. The NCC, which is a different body, would not have taken into account the more recent statements. So, you know, I think it's appropriate for the NEC to ask the NCC, I'm sorry for sounding so bureaucratic, to look at this again, and perhaps we should have some more details about how they came to this judgment.
If action isn't taken, would you consider resigning from the Shadow Cabinet?
No, I'm not going to resign from the Shadow Cabinet. I'm very busy taking on the government and their incompetent handling and underfunding of the NHS. Yes.
John Ashworth, thank you for talking to us. We may work longer hours than many other European workers, but our output per hour is 30% below that of many of our economic rivals. For many years, ministers have been trying to work out how to solve this so-called productivity gap. Figures out this morning suggest there's been an improvement. Productivity grew at its fastest rate in more than a year in the final 3 months of 2016. Efforts to narrow the gap further are likely to include more spending on infrastructure, education and training. But as our business correspondent Jonty Bloom reports, one of Britain's biggest failings is that family-owned and run firms are far less productive than other companies. He's been to Chichester to try to find out why.
Nature's Way Foods near Chichester started 22 years ago, when two local brothers, who are also farmers, decided to start packing their own lettuces. Now it employs well over 1,000 workers, more in high season, producing bagged salads, fruit and prepared veg for restaurants and major supermarkets like Tesco. Rob Prowse is the production manager.
In here we'll slice it, dice it, shred it, whatever the customer requirements are.
And that looks pretty much like shredded cabbage to me.
It is like, just like shredded cabbage, you've definitely got it right.
But although Nature's Way is still family owned by those two brothers, as its chief executive, Susan Barrett, told me, it is no longer family-run, and it hasn't been for years.
I joined the business 12 years ago now as finance and systems director, and then became CEO. So Robert Langmead, one of the brothers, was CEO at the time and then became chairman. and now just sits on the board as a non-exec, and I have an independent chairman. That brings some real skill and knowledge into the board, as well as the two brothers, obviously, with their entrepreneurial, ambitious kind of drive. It feels like a really strong unit.
That's almost certainly a good thing, because family-owned and run firms are notoriously unproductive. Output per worker is almost 30% less than for a multinational company, while family-owned firms that are run by professional outsiders like Susan are much more efficient, in fact, almost as good as multinationals. That helps explain why Nature's Way Foods has expanded so rapidly and has all the latest equipment.
So basically this is a production line, the plastic tubs going one end and then people measure out enough cabbage, enough carrot, enough lettuce as it goes down, and then right at the end the pots are sealed.
In fact, every time you hear this, another three bowls of salad are sealed and weighed ready for the shops. But that level of investment is less common in family-run firms. One reason is that they don't attract top managers to work for them. After all, if you want to make it to the top, a family-run firm where the son or daughter is promised the boss's job, come what may, is not really where you want to work, almost by definition, says Dr. Eakin-Smith.
One of the accepted definitions is that it's a firm that runs with the express purpose of having something to pass down through the generations. And the expectation would be that the younger generation will take on the firm as they mature and get older. And within that kind of sort of business culture, you're not necessarily trying to maximise profits or bring in the best managers, because you're expecting your offspring to manage that firm.
Not only that, but what are the chances that the best and most qualified person to run a business just happens to be a relative of the founder? Although that isn't to say family firms don't have a lot going for them. For a start, people really like working there.
Thanks, Amy.
If the people at Chichester Farmers Market are any guide, everyone wants to work for one.
Would you rather work for a family company or a larger public organisation?
Larger company has lots of benefits, family company, a bit nicer maybe, depends what you need.
Family company.
Why?
Because they'll look after their employees more.
Family.
Oh, family company.
Always a family.
I just like the whole ethos of people working together for the same aims and everybody knowing each other.
That's because people feel that they're more friendly, relaxed and nicer places to work. But Susan Barrett believes she's the best of both worlds, a professional operation but with just a couple of bosses to please.
Well, the great thing about being family-owned, from my point of view, is that you really can take a long-term view. Pressure of delivering specific numbers to the city is not there. I mean, obviously, we have targets that we strive for, but fundamentally, it's not quite the same pressure as it is in a PLC.
For the British economy as a whole, it would be better if there were more businesses which thought that way. There are lots of good reasons for having a family-run business. It's just that efficiency, productivity and profits are not always top of the list.
Jonty Bloom reporting. A woman who tried to sue Trump International for breaching her privacy under data protection laws has lost her case. Rowan Bates, who's 62, took on the company after being told that there was mobile phone footage of her that had been recorded while she was urinating in sand dunes near the company's golf course in Aberdeenshire. Originally, police charged her with an offence, but no action was taken. Our reporter, Katrina Renton, is outside the court in Edinburgh. And tell us more about the case, Katrina.
Well, Martha, this was the case of one woman against a giant organisation. Rowan Bates was taking on Trump International, of course. Now, the story was that she'd been walking with a friend and she had to go through the golf course at Menny to get onto the beach there. Now, when she went onto the beach, she found that she needed to go to the bathroom urgently. She said she had a medical condition. So she went in sand dunes where she thought no one could see her. Now, this golf course has been controversial and Rowan Bates was known to be an opponent of it. And she's never made any secret of that. But when she was on the beach, when she went to the loo, she found out that she had been filmed secretly by three men, two of them employees of Trump International. Now, police came to her door and she was shocked when they charged her with urinating in a public place. No action was taken, and then she turned the tables and took a claim to the small claims court here in Edinburgh. Now, she lost the case as it had been based on Trump International at many not being registered as a data controller under the Data Protection Act, and the sheriff ruled that it was not this that had caused her distress. But he told her she had legally urinated on the course. He said Trump International had made a frivolous complaint to police about her. And he went on to say, officious men taking photos of women urinating in the countryside risk prosecution. Now, Rowan Bates gave this reaction outside court.
For me, it's a moral victory, a real moral victory. I wasn't in it for the money. I was in it to clear my name because I'd been accused of doing something deliberately. I was accused of doing it in full view of people. I could see nobody.
And Katrina, has there been any reaction from Trump International?
Yes, there has been a statement issued by Trump International. They say that they're satisfied that justice has prevailed. They say that the claim was disingenuous by Rowan Bates and it was a perversion of the truth and nothing more than a poor attempt at self-publicity in an effort to garner support for her anti-Trump, anti-business propaganda. Now, Rowan Bates, of course, says that she has won the moral victory here today.
Katrina Renton in Edinburgh. And our closing headline. The UN Security Council is meeting in New York this afternoon to discuss the alleged chemical weapons attack in Syria that killed around 70 people. In the city a short time ago, the 100 share index was up 11 points at 7,333. This is Martha Carney, and that's The World at 1:45. You can find more podcasts of documentaries and current affairs at bbc.co.uk/radio4.